NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
The Flight Safety Detectives is bringing on a new sponsor, Piston Powered, a power-by-the-hour program for owners of piston-powered aircraft that can stabilize the long-term cost of owning your airplane.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives, and we do have a guest today, which we will get to here shortly. But I just wanted to say hello. John and I just got back from a couple of days down in Daytona Beach, Florida, attending the NAFI Aviation Safety Summit for flight instructors, but it was open to more than just flight instructors. I actually spoke to the group as far as the summit is concerned, and then John and I had the opportunity to speak in to the ISASI, that's the International Society of Air Safety Investigators chapter, that is headed by Anthony Brickhouse, who's a professor down at Embry-Riddle. And we had about 50 students who have become members of that particular organization. And not taking away from Nick and the fact that we're going to be talking about unmanned vehicles here shortly, John and I will open up the next show with a debrief of what came out of the NAFI summit as far as the safety initiatives and the discussions, because there is a big concern right now that the failure rate for all certificates and ratings is at a really an all-time high. And not only are the DPEs frustrated with the candidates that are coming forward, and again, we have CFIs that are pushing these students forward, including CFIs who have taught CFIs. So we're going to get into a lot of that in the next show at the beginning, because there's a lot of information that's coming forward. And we're going to also talk basically about the fact that the FAA right now with the new administration is in a lot of discord. The top echelon of the FAA, the administrator, the deputy administrator, and a number of high-ranking executives in the FAA have left the agency. And so the question now is, who's going to run it? We know that the interims never really run the agency, and who's going to be appointed. So we'll be getting into a lot of that in the next show. But given all of that, I'm going to let John or you, Todd, introduce our guest.
Well, John will do a much better job than that. And having known Mr. Lapos for quite some time, I will add this before John says anything. Nick has a unique perspective on aviation, starting in the 1960s or 1970s, I'm not sure which, as a gunship pilot in Vietnam flying the Huey Cobra. Am I correct with the model and name?
That's
there?
Right. Yep. Yep. 1968, I started. I soloed in 68.
An aircraft, which the thing that I remember about that, it's only about 3 feet wide at the cockpit.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But John, take it away with talking about his work with the AIAA and dealing with the future of air mobility.
AIAA has been a leader in developing systems for aviation for 60 years. that I know of. I think it came to life in the 60s. And it's basically a whole bunch of people from around the world, mostly engineers, aeronautical, airspace, a whole bunch of specialties around aviation. And they have sort of set standards that others have built upon to develop the air system that we have today. And not long ago, AIAA commissioned a group of people to take a look at this whole unmanned aerial area, not just the hauling passengers like Joby and other companies, but the entire spectrum of airspace and airspace use and what we need to be thinking about as we go forward. That includes things like the certification of the vehicles, the electronics that go into the vehicles, and also the air traffic control issues, which I'm very concerned about. So Nick is the chairman or co-chairman of the committee, and he is actually the author of the air traffic management piece for this five-section study. And he has been around aviation, like he said, Domenico, since the middle 60s, which I have him beat, by the way. And without further ado, why don't we just get into it? Because this subject needs all the attention it can get.
Welcome, Nick.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg.
I've got a question. Give us a Reader's Digest overview of what has transpired over the last 5 to 7 years in ramping up in preparation for the air mobility, and the fact that, again, and we're going to get more specific about unmanned vehicles and some of the issues that have cropped up even recently, but just give us an idea of where the industry is going and what the short-term future looks like, because we're going to have a lot of problems in this ramp up. And unfortunately, I think those problems could be catastrophic. You know, give us a Reader's Digest view of where we're going, how the industry is ramped up to this point, and what the short-term future looks like as far as getting ramped up and really working through the trials and tribulations as we start to saturate the airspace with these unmanned vehicles.
And let me answer this by offering up that the future is probably a bit different than we see in the press. If you see the air taxi operators and the manned vehicles that will probably replace helicopters in short term for some inner city uses, those are interesting and important, but the actual money and the business base will be spread in a pyramid that runs downward to letter carrying machines and upward towards 20 and 30 kilogram machines that carry packages and other things. In fact, the business base that we look at was reported by the GAO as being the FAA needs to be looking at where the future business is going to be. The idea that, for example, the FAA has asked for machines to see and avoid, detect and avoid, and that every unmanned machine has to have the detection devices on it, that probably creates a threshold of economic cost for the machine that will supplant the ability to do letter carrying and so on, because there's just not enough business space to do that. We think that the FAA, however, is being very wise in not disrupting today's very safe and very effective air traffic system for a future promise. But as the future begins to build, we think there needs to be the beginnings now of a technical future that creates an air traffic network that involves all air vehicles in the same airspace. We're talking to each other through a network. And if you could picture, it's like our cell phones and like ADS-B. So that in fact, what happens is even the smallest drones are capable of carrying these because they're not terribly expensive or heavy. And the largest, a 777, is also part of that system as well. And that the air traffic system that it results from this is a network that allows prioritization and safety shielding for the big human carrying machines and the medium human carrying machines, but also then allows the smallest machines to do their business. And it's that we picture as being probably where the future wants to be, and we need to start now constructing it.
Okay, so And that opens up the door for a lot of questions, of course. But right now with air traffic, especially commercial air traffic, we have really specified routes. While general aviation, we can go anywhere and do anything. We don't follow a particular route necessarily. The commercial operators, when we're flight planning, we're on Victor Airways or we're going point to point and things like that. With these unmanned vehicles, though, it is the big sky concept where, I mean, if you're dropping packages, you're going everywhere and anywhere at any time. How do we prevent chaos? And I understand the technology of the see and avoid, because see and avoid, you got to see and avoid the other unmanned vehicles, but you also have to see and avoid the manned vehicles, if you will, the aircraft that are in the air. So how do you control that chaos?
It's a great question. And really, we have to recognize that see and avoid really means that you know where the other folks are and that you and they together share this airspace and you can avoid each other. I could picture, for example, the drones could have their autopilots all connected together. But rather than see and avoid, it's that everyone signs into the network and the network provides the quasi-sensor that feeds back again so all the air vehicles know where the other air vehicles are and can avoid them. Not a visual system, but very similar to what your cell phone does when you go on Google Maps and you see a red zone because this traffic has slowed down. The red zone is really just all the cell phones in that area all slowing down, and Google converts that to a red route. So the suggestion that we have is that we would begin to plan on a future air traffic system. Probably would take about 5 or 10 years to implement, and that air traffic system would be a full network. And the network would serve as a quasi sensor and also as both a controller and advisor.
Is it a fair characterization that it's basically an ADS-B system on steroids?
That's exactly right. ADS-B is a fine way to describe it. However, the bandwidth and the cost of ADS-B both preclude it being propagated to every vehicle. But if you look at our cell phone technology, strip away the battery, strip away the screen, you're left with a small motherboard. It's very possible that a cell phone type technology brought to a future world that has extremely high integrity and high self-reporting could be the way we go, and that every vehicle would have it. And I must underscore that the drone problem is a major one. How do we know how much we've got a problem? The dented leading edge of that firefighting aircraft tells you. I mean, that was a miracle that it didn't harm somebody. Also, if you just open up eBay and put in drone in eBay and look at the 19,000 hits you'll get being sold every day. Greg, you said we're in a problem. We are, because I think I heard the word Yahoo was described a little earlier in this conversation. Everyone's got one, and boy, we as a people are maybe not as equipped to be disciplined with regard to how we fly these things.
We know that they're not disciplined because they're out there creating havoc. Again, whether it's over a disaster scene like the fires, over some other tragedy somewhere else, over a car, it doesn't matter because they're trying to capture video and then trying, of course, to peddle it for bucks and that kind of thing. Todd, I'll let you ask a question because I got a number of follow-ups with Nick.
Well, that brings into view the Part 107 part of the smaller operators out there, those who are responsible, who are doing commercial work with it right now. It sounds that given the kind of market that the future air mobility type of vehicles will serve and the kind of technology that will need to be on it, anything that's out there right now flying at the high end of Part 107 might not be equipped for this. So that installed base of aircraft, whoever's flying right now, they would have to essentially replace that with a new technology in order to play by the new rules. Has that figured into the conversation as to whether or not this is going to be viable and not disrupting who's using commercial drones now?
That's a great question, and it really, I think it has to. We have to recognize that that future world is going to require us to have future systems. The FAA, I think today, would like to have partitioned airspace, 400 feet and below, routes constructed. And by the way, routes are the worst way to handle traffic because all you do is making jams. Instead, if you could picture how this future world would work, the network systems, everyone logs onto the network. The network then takes the intentions of the air vehicles and lays out possibles for for them, and they go and fly that route. And there are bubbles around the aircraft to avoid each other, and there are big bubbles around airliners and big bubbles around air taxi operators with humans on board, so that everything else avoids them. And it could be done. This involves some invention, but I tell you what, the Europeans already started down this path. There's an airspace system that they're developing that has many of the elements I'm describing here.
I have no expertise in this area, but one thing that comes to mind, given my level of expertise, this sounds like some sort of distributed artificial intelligence drone-type swarming technology where you have X number of vehicles in a fairly limited space, and they have to make, out of necessity, decisions in real time. There will not be a remote human operator able to take in all the information and make decisions for multiple aircraft. So given that as a possibility, what is the thought as far as one of the risks that happens when you have semi-autonomous systems, such as the stock market, where suddenly you might have what they call a flash crash? The stock market drops hundreds of points in moments for no apparent reason. And you have to step in there and manually put the brakes on things for things to reset. So I have a lot of stuff there. Again, I don't have expertise. A, the drones will have some level of intelligence. B, what if they lose it momentarily?
And the answer to these is going to occur when an expert committee helps to draw up the MOPs for the system and starts to develop TSOs for the system. It'll have to be. And quite frankly, the RTCA serves as a very good framework for having built this system. But let me describe a little bit more about some of the areas that artificial intelligence, if you will, and I'm not sure I like that term very much, but high degrees of automation built into a system like this. You have to have an understanding of how indeterminate systems operate. Right to this second, most of the folks who build advanced systems think of them as determinate systems. And then your validation is done by changing all the input variables and watching the output doesn't blow up. We know that doesn't work. If you taught your teenage son how to drive, the first thing you showed him was how to pull over the curb. Now, if we have systems that are artificially intelligent to some aspect, but have shells around them that protect the system and the public by having protections that say, look, if you go beyond 60 degrees of bank, we're going to stop you. The calculations aren't working anymore, and we're going to have this other shell slip in and protect the air vehicle and the system around it. And we do that all the time. How many check rides have I given? How many check rides have we all given? And what we do is take indeterminate systems like an 18-year-old kid and decide whether they're safe enough to go fly. And that safety is not because they manipulate the airplane so perfectly. It's because they know when to stop manipulating and start controlling the flight path safely and protecting themselves and the area around them. In other words, that indeterminate systems can be protected by having shells of behavior that show judgment.
So, Nick, when we think about all of this and as everything gets upscaled, are we going to have a TMO, a traffic management office, that's going to look at just drones, since we have a traffic management office that's looking at every aircraft in the air, trying to keep some semblance of sanity, especially when there's weather events or, you know, outages and things like that?
Let me see if I can answer that. And of course, I'm going to give you just my opinion. And I'm reasonably expert in some areas and a fool in others. So there's a vision, though, that says that you probably would not have a separate drone entity. You have an air traffic management system, and that your 777s are in there, too. And in fact, they're the king. And they get to go anywhere they want to. And when they show up, everyone else runs to a corner. If you could picture like when a shark goes on a reef, every one of the reef fish run to the corners. Well, I think you'd have that same thing. But on the other hand, you would not be able to say that the drones can't operate in some areas. It's a temporal control, that the time management is what determines how the airspace runs. So that when the 777 shows up, everyone leaves. But when that 777 lands, comes down the ILS at Teterboro and lands, then behind them are the drones that operate to deliver packages and letters to the neighborhoods underneath the ILS path. And the system knows where they are and understands where they are, flags that in fact they're safe, because since they're already known, then when a 777 comes down the path the next time, everyone gets out of the way, or a warning's issued. And we can understand that. I'm gonna offer something up. Today we deal with voices and permissions and add 10 knots, please, because you're too much space between you and the guy ahead of you. That's not how it can operate. The future system will operate the way FedEx operates packages today. The days before Christmas, FedEx operates so that they have 20.5 million packages in their system, and they know where every package is within 100 meters. It's a data system because we have good data. And so if we set up a system that's like that and have humans that intercede when we see dangers occurring, the alarm bells sound or the screen turns red because hey, here comes that airliner and these guys aren't getting out of the way, we can address that and make it work. But it does involve every vehicle being logged into the system, and every vehicle is a partner in the way the system operates.
As with other aircraft, there will probably be densities of operation much higher in some areas than others. Manhattan, for instance, fairly high. And for a wholly different set of reasons, Beverly Hills might be a very high traffic area because, hey, if you need to have your package quicker than FedEx and Amazon can get it delivered, why not fly it in? Which brings up the issue of if this is successful, if we do have thousands or maybe tens of thousands of flights per day, these aren't going to be silent aircraft. What kind of pushback socially do you expect from having this new kind of aviation up close and personal over at least some, not all, neighborhoods?
Well, and very specific noise-sensitive areas, especially over parks and wildlife preserves and all of that kind of thing.
That's right. And in fact, I think what we're going to find is that we'll determine what those thresholds of public acceptance are and build machines that meet them nicely. There is no reason why we can't make a drone that's nearly perfectly silent. It will cost some weight efficiency and some power efficiency, but that pales in comparison to having neighbors that tell you you can't fly anymore over here. So I think those all have to be addressed. The most important of them all is safety.
Well, good. I'm glad you brought that word up.
Yeah.
And John, I think you got cut off there. Go ahead.
I have a question, Nick.
Yeah.
And we see all the time about air traffic control workload. Have you looked at what kind of workload increase this would give to traffic controllers in certain segments? You know, as Greg said, we don't need to have a separate system for these people. It needs to be integrated. I think you said the same thing. And if we integrate it, what effect does that have on our existing controller force?
I think we have to recognize that humans have a given amount of workload they can perform, and a breakdown then that occurs if they work more than that on their accuracy. So the question then is, how much is automated and how much is flagged so the human only sees the problems and can help resolve them? That I don't picture the system as operating so that humans tell a drone where to go. I picture that most of the system works relatively automatically, and that when there's a danger close, if you will, when two machines come too close to each other, the system flags it, and the human operator then is warned to go ahead and enter into the equation and help decide what to do, even so much as hit the red button and tell all the drones to get away. So, John, I think we can make that work, but it's only going to work when a committee of people from each of the walks of life sit around a table and decide how to make this thing work.
And when you talk about safety, Nick, you know, one of the other major concerns I have are runaways. We've had a number of events take place where the mass drone shows, where there's hundreds of drones dancing in the sky for a show. All of a sudden, they lose or there's a spurious signal that interferes with whatever signal is being pumped up to the ship. And like in Florida, where a bunch of them come tumbling down well out of the safety zones that were set up, or you have a delivery drone carrying a 50-pound package that some spurious signal crosses its path and it crashes through the roof of someone's house. How do we protect the airspace from those spurious signals or whatever events, mechanical, abnormal operation, whatever you want to call it? How do we prevent that? Because when we have these mass numbers of drones, those kinds of things are going to probably escalate. I mean, we have accidents with aircraft, as you know, but You know, this is this is on a whole different scale.
You bet it is. And in fact, the scale is the question. I do believe this, that the safety of the operations has to be based upon the integrity of the devices themselves. And today's drones do not address that at all. I mean, anyone with a soldering iron can make a drone. And you sell them on eBay, and then off you go. And when you see a drone show, you're seeing a show of vehicles that are all somewhat too marginal to behave in the manner that I'm describing the future has to be. An air traffic system over a populated area has to have a level of integrity that is assured, and that's one of the great things the FAA is good at. I
The
mean,
technology might have a level of integrity, but the people operating that technology is a whole different question. If you have the drone systems that can sense one another and can communicate with one another, how resilient is that going to be against someone who will want to, not because they're taking pictures of a fire, but because they're delivering packages in an urban area and they don't want those packages tracked, yet they're in the same airspace as the drones are paying attention?
That's a great question. And I think we're going to have some resolution of these kinds of questions at a public level. And it has to be one where the users, and these are the Amazons, for example, and the DHLs and the FedExes that have to be weighing in as well. Now, let me offer up where that vision is, at least for Amazon. Bob Whittington is one of the people at Amazon who's developing air vehicles for the future. If you can believe it, they have a vice president of air vehicles at Amazon.
Great.
Right? And Bob said in a symposium that I attended that he believes that in 2029, Amazon will deliver 1/2 a billion packages by eVTOL.
It's a great vision, and it's definitely going to change aviation as we know it. But it's always that ramp up period
That's exactly.
where, I mean, people want to say that I'm at the end of my career. Hell, I'm starting a new career with all of these EVs because I mean, there is going to be a lot of work. Are companies going to be required to be set up like airlines where you have not only the ops department, but you're going to have a very full-fledged safety department? And then, of course, developing those protocols because not every operation is going to be identical. I mean, how do we police all of that?
It's not going to grow by itself. It's going to grow because there's a willful act by a group of capable people to write up the rules and regulations with FAA oversight to make sure it happens. And it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen by growing like Topsy. It's going to happen because we planned it. I'm going to
And
give some examples, just if I can.
sure.
Just when the United States shifted to railroads running the show, there was a plan on where the railroads would go, the right of ways they would have, and the laws that would conduct that allow railroads to have public right of ways and how they behave. The FCC does the same thing with frequency allocation. Everything you're describing, Greg, and you show really good prescience will be the same kind of thing for the drones. And there'll be some sort of, I mean, we're in an age today where people say that the government's no good and we can't have oversight. That's backwards. In
Yeah.
fact, business wants the government to set reasonable rules so when they meet the rules, they can operate. They don't want it to be where they build something and then find out later it doesn't work and the government won't allow it to operate.
And I think, from looking at it from a regulatory standpoint, and we all know that regulations are made to be broken, but one of the big issues, and it really started with trying to track offenders of lasers, pointing lasers at aircraft and trying to track their position and then, take the corrective action against the offender. We have these drones out there that we can't identify, we can't track, we don't see them on radar. I mean, we're going to have to be a bit forceful in the regulation and say that anything built, from this day forward is going to have some level of tracking or at least ability to pump a signal out that we can identify a rogue drone, because we're going to have these operators that are going to be doing their own thing for their own reasons, whether it's crossing the border with good stuff or bad stuff, it doesn't matter. But they're going to try and skirt the rules and skirt the system. I mean, we got airplanes that fly under the radar, if you will, to do that. How do we prevent drones from being used in that manner?
Yeah, and how do we prevent our society to be exposed to horrendous crimes that could be committed by those drones?
Yes.
The answer is, I believe, number one, is that we talk about having the proper kind of module that goes on every drone and every manned machine that makes them join the system. And then the second part of it is, how do we find out someone who's not in the system? And the answer is, for the high-risk areas, I say answer, a possible answer, if you have LIDARs that look for vehicles, and you can find them pretty darn easily, then you look at the vehicle and the LIDAR says, oh, I see that vehicle. That vehicle's in my system. So the rogues will automatically be detected, and we can protect ourselves then against the rogues. And I believe we'll end up having a system that has the ability to see 360 around all our cities and find the drones that are operating. But those drones are correlated against the network, and therefore they're acceptable. And if the drones don't correlate, then we have ways to sterilize the system as a result.
Now, there is a certain population of people who, for whatever reason, want to fly a drone. It's not 100% of the population. It's not 0%. And there's going to be a certain percentage who'll still do that. Myself personally, I happen to have a 2020 version of a DJI drone under 250 grams, so I didn't have to register it then. I don't have to register it now. But I'm not so hardcore that I'm going to go out there and get a customized large drone to do stupid things in the air. But those people will exist. Here's a big question. It's a social question. What's the market for this sort of rogue operation? Is it in the tens of thousands, or in the millions? Depending on the magnitude of that problem will determine how much of an issue it will be for everyone who's trying to operate in the system.
And my answer would be this. It's going to happen anyway. So the question is, how do we keep the chaos of all the good actors behaving themselves and then weed out the bad actors? But if we don't build something for the good actors, we have chaos all the way around. And I also think that there's an issue of not preparing for the future. If you think of detect and avoid on every drone, if you think about the beyond visual line of sight, the phrases are being used all the time. Can I be bold enough to say, in this future world where all the air vehicles are stabilized, there's no such thing as VFR versus IFR. Why? Why? VFR means I have the ability to control my machine by visual reference to horizon and to all the obstructions around me. Well, if we build a system properly, it automatically has VFR capability, even in IFR.
Yeah.
You know, and I must, I'm being a little bit radical here, but I think it's important for us to recognize that some of the old paradigms are going to have to be stripped away. But we built an interstate highway system that changed the United States. One of the beautiful things is going out and buying a 68 Chevy literally today for $2,000, putting a key in the ignition and go to New York.
Yeah.
The freedom that it gives our society is unbelievable. And I believe that we can harness that same thing into this future world if we prepare ourselves with the right air traffic management system and the right public protections for that system.
Who do you think, what country do you think would be first and foremost in getting this out the door, because they don't have the level of regulation and level of legal restrictions we have here? And I'm not saying this in a bad way. It's like, look, if you have a country like, I'll just pick one out of the hat, Kuwait, that mm-hmm. has a small, wealthy population and are innovative in many ways when it comes to energy and banking and such, why not be innovative in this way? Is there any country out there that's going to be ahead of the United States with trying and failing at doing this first?
I think that's going to occur. I believe that, in fact, you can't stop it. There are many countries which will permit operations that wouldn't be permitted by a CAA or an FAA or an EASA, because those entities exist in the modern world to protect. And I recognize here, I was a DER at one point, and I worked with the FAA on three different certification programs for the company I worked for. And I must tell you, they got their hearts in the right place. And if you go to Kuwait or Abu Dhabi and you operate a drone and then it flies through a window and harms somebody, the whole world look at it and say, what happened? What just happened? One of the problems we have is we're talking about the idea that a city like New York, is it unreasonable to expect if they have 10,000 box trucks that enter New York every given day that that city might have 5 or 10,000 drones operating to deliver packages and deliver letters, deliver prescription drugs and pizzas. Can we expect that in the future? Not only can we expect it, we want it. The public wants it. The DoorDash today doesn't work very well because you have to pay a human to come along. But if DoorDash was a drone that costs 20 cents a mile to operate and so on, it'll work out fine. So my belief is that we'll end up adapting the systems that create the economic world that helps us. A mother whose child is sick and is on the phone with the doctor at 2 in the morning, and the doctor says, CVS is sending your package. You'll have your prescription drugs will be on your front porch in 20 minutes. That's something that's much better than thinking about a taxi, eVTOL that takes somebody to the opera by landing on the roof of the opera building. We don't want the world to think that that's where our world is going. Our world is going so that each one of us can benefit from all this. I tend to be a futurist, and I must tell you, if you look in the past at how things have been changed by the technologies that are out there, did you know that when Robert Fulton invented the steamboat, 20 years later, the population of St. Louis was 10 times its original population? Because the steamboat allowed the goods to go up the Mississippi River without being pulled. We don't even realize that. Our nation is made of technological change like this. And unlike most societies in the world, we embrace it, and we put it to use. Use the telephone, the VCR. I mean, think about it.
Am I going to be able to geofence my house if I don't want them flying over or around my property?
I believe that to the degree that you can protect yourself, the answer is probably yes. Probably yes. And we'll let that shake out. We'll see what happens. Do you want drones flying past your window? By no means. That's an intrusion. Can a drone fly 200 feet over your house or 300 feet over your house and not intrude on you? We'll figure where that line is, Greg, and you'll tell us, and we'll adjust that. But let me offer an example.
So that means that maybe someday my super duper killer laser that I have that I've invented, well, I can use that too if I really get annoyed by drones flying over my house.
A microwave transmitter. I can help you build one.
Got it. Okay. I'm calling you.
Drone. Yeah. But if you think about this, let me offer what this future world might look like. We have a fire department today. You have a problem in your house. You pick up the phone, you call, and the fire department is running. What if the fire department had drones that circled the city and saw the heat inside your roof before you picked up the phone? I mean, that will happen. Why? Because it's a good thing. And when it does happen, lives will be saved because of it.
What about the competition that exists between the kind of operations, cargo operations you're talking about, which will not have humans on board, versus the advanced air mobility folks who are, in many cases, heavily funded by venture capital, who want to impose their own vision of advanced aviation? And there might be some conflict between that and the package delivery side of things. Is that something, outside of the technical aspects of it, is that something that might set up a showdown, as it were, as to who will have hold sway over the airspace?
And let me just add one more element to that, Nick.
Yep.
Flying cars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let me offer up. I believe you're going to find that the big question of whether humans can fly in a machine that is not being controlled by human will be answered in the next 20 years or so. I'm going to give you some statistics just to give you a feeling for that. There was once a discussion like this about elevators. Should you have buttons on the elevator that send it to the floors? In 1925, Macy's, there was an elevator operator with white gloves on, and he or she opened and closed the doors sequentially and actually flew the elevator to the floors. You know, there was a slot on the bottom of the elevator, and there's a white stripe on the floor, and they would center the white stripe in the slot to know they were on the right floor, open the inner doors, open the outer doors, let people in and out. Do you know that the safety record of elevators when humans were operating it was approximately 100 times worse than the safety record today?
And interesting.
We have this idea that humans are, I mean, I hear this, I look on LinkedIn, people are, you know, passing their guts out about how could you possibly think about a single pilot airliner? I said, what about two pilots saved all those airliners? Our airline accidents today are almost all the result of human error, almost all the result of crew human error, some maintenance human error, but they're all human error. And so the idea that you'd have two pilots, does that make you safer? I'd love to get into a solid discussion with somebody about what I'd rather have would be a artificially intelligent co-pilot that advised the pilot and saw all the jams you could get into. And eventually, maybe if it would be, it'd be unpiloted.
Okay, so now I'll give you a couple scenarios. Hawaiian Airlines, zip top, 737, top goes off the aircraft. Okay.
Oh, yeah. That one. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Or you have United 811, where you blow a hole in the side of the aircraft from an engine, or the cargo door leaves the aircraft. Who are you going to send back there to assess? It's sure not going to be a flight attendant or a passenger. I mean, they sent the flight engineer back to assess the damage on that. Or how do you program the system, the artificial intelligence, and you take the Miracle on the Hudson? I mean, that was a human determination that I can't make it back to LaGuardia. I can't make it to Teterboro. We're putting it down in the water. Will artificial intelligence, will unmanned aircraft make that same type of decision?
Greg, I the only thing I could counter that with is, first off, it doesn't mean there's not a human on board. Okay, that's number one. And number two is, you pick the cherries. Okay, for every Sully, there are 50 pilots in the third world who crashed their airplane because they couldn't figure out how to get the gear down.
I agree.
I'm sorry. Yeah. I have to say this, and I'm a pilot. I'm a professional aviator. I've trained so many people. I feel very proud of my profession. But I do believe that there's a way to help organize this so you get both. Okay?
I think,
and I must tell you, advanced control laws, I have patents for some of the fly-by-wire stuff for helicopters. We have changed the way they behave so that, I must tell you this, our flight office secretary went out in one of our test airplanes. We had her fly precision helicopter maneuvers with our advanced controls from the Comanche, and she could have passed the requirements for a pilot because our system was so easy to fly. So the answer, I think, Greg, is a little bit of all of that together.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, because that's, you know, I'm a safety, you know, advocate, but, you know, I'm always shooting at safety.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that we have a robust system that, you know, we aren't putting Band-Aid fixes in or putting something out there. And it's we'll wait and see what happens and then fix it when it happens. We've been down that road with some of the technology that we've put into aircraft, or even spent gazillions of dollars. Microwave landing systems. How much money did we throw at microwave landing systems to make things, quote, safer for aviation? And it never came to fruition.
That's right. And meanwhile, it was supplanted entirely by GPS.
Yes.
That's right. And when you talk about LOS and WAS running GPS approaches, they're brilliant. I'll offer up that the air traffic management system I'm describing, that is a possibility for the future, is a utility like GPS is. And if you handle it that way, and then you say, okay, I've got this thing, it's got the integrity and the reliability that we need, how would I put it to use? Watch how it changes the way we behave.
Before you go on, I have one question for you, Nick. When you mentioned the system that you had in the Comanche program. This is not the fixed-wing Comanche. We're talking about the military aircraft program Comanche?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And we basically took all of the foibles of a helicopter and ironed them out. A fly-by-wire system could make, I used to tell people, we could make the Comanche fly like a B-52. You couldn't tell the difference. That also means, though, that we could create a set of control laws. Remember I mentioned the idea of shells that protect the machine. We could actually make a machine today where you could get into a helicopter and try and fly into a tree and it won't let you. Think about riding a horse. A horse won't let you run off a cliff. The horse is smarter than that. What if our machines were that smart as well? And wouldn't let you hit a wall because it could see the wall, and even though you're pushing on the control, it said, I can't let you do that. I can't let you do that.
It's definitely gonna be an interesting, changing world in aviation, you know, and we're not talking the next 50 years, even though it will, but we're talking the next 5 years, because all of this is coming fast and furious.
That's right.
And it's going to be of real interest. I mean, you know, the question is there a limit? I mean, we're going to have humans programming, you know, AI to an extent, and then all of a sudden AI is going to be learning from AI. Who's going to be programming these, you know, aeronautical vehicles and machines?
And as I said, I think the actual protection there, and quite frankly, I've never read it anywhere, is the idea of doing what we as aviators do when we give a check ride, is look for the judgment. Does your system possess judgment? If I have a drone and the drone is AI controlled, and the drone says, I've had enough, I'm going to land in that ball field over there, you give the drone an A. It gets its wings. And we have not talked about that, that in fact, the way that you get through this AI problem is by not having AI all powerful. That AI only governs you until a point where you have expressed a need to take control of the flight and do it properly. The way Sully did. Sully, he overrode every single thing and said, I'm putting the airplane down. And everyone walked away. It was absolutely brilliant.
Well, the three of us are definitely available to join an advisory committee so that we can start working on that right now, because we can't wait. We can't wait till we got a fleet of these things and things start to happen and go, oh, well, yeah, we should have done that. No, there can't be any we should have done. It's got to start to be really a very proactive look into the future that you're describing. We just don't have the opportunity to wait and see how it goes.
That's correct.
From a safety perspective.
And if we do it properly so that the right stakeholders are involved, all of us are involved, it will end up producing a new set of rules. It's going to be interesting. Did you ever see that movie about Steve Prefontaine, who his coach invented Nike shoes, and his shoes came apart on the third lap of a four-lap race?
Yeah.
And the coach said, I got one lap to go. We're making our shoes as we're running. And we have to do that wisely and carefully. But if we don't plan on that change, and frankly, no, we're not planning on it. I don't know anyone who's talking about a future air traffic world. But if we don't have one, then we're going to take today's world and the limitations of today's world, and we're going to have them projected into the future. And it'll be clumsy. It won't work.
Well, with all the tech folks in the new administration, hopefully somebody's listening to us. They'll pick up the phone and call us and go, hey, why don't you boys come over here and join us, you know, and talk about what's going on, because the tech is going to take over. And again, we have to stay ahead. We really have to stay ahead of it. We cannot afford to fall behind.
That's right. And when the tech tries to take over, the tech has to be governed by the very good cops that the FAA is, that they can govern and check public safety, and that's very important to us. Yeah.
So I think it's time for us to say a second to last word. Not us, me saying the second to last word. In that,
Todd, why don't you say the second to the last word?
Why don't I do that? This has been a fascinating discussion. And as I said in the opening, our guest here, Nick, has been in aviation since roughly half a century ago. In fact, I think I'm the youngest amongst the group. I'm the only one who hasn't been in aviation at least half a century, but close to it. Mm-hmm. What's my second to last word? There's stuff happening. This is not a static sort of industry. If you have the experience, if you have the desire to get involved in this at whatever level, AIAA, industry, government, etc., there's opportunity galore. You just have to go out there and grab it. And this is one of those emerging opportunities that has space for anyone with the desire.
Well said.
So with that, John, we will leave you with our last word.
And for all our flyers looking at today, not tomorrow, I'll ask you that if you're going to go fly your airplane, do a very good job of pre-planning. Do it at the hotel or at home before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. And if it doesn't agree, find out why. When you get out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. You know, just in Florida last week, I had a discussion with a number of young pilots, and looking at airplanes and telling them things to look at in general sense on every airplane when you do a pre-flight. And after your pre-flight and you get in the air, please put the head on a swivel, because we have an awful lot of people flying today, learning to fly, and they're going to make mistakes. Don't you be part of their mistake. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.